Hey there, web or podcast listeners. I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited to make it a little bit shorter and a little bit sweeter. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. While the human impact of Hurricane Florence is of top concern, there are other impacts on wildlife that are interesting to note. Birds in the path of the storm have been blown off course, and some have ridden out the storm by keeping themselves directly in its eye, where the winds and rain are significantly calmer. Many birds familiar to us here in Vermont are on their way south right now and could have been in the storm's path. So today we're going to find out how they deal with a storm of that magnitude. We'll talk about lots of other bird-related news and observations as well, because we're going to spend the whole show today with Bridget Butler. She's a birding enthusiast and consultant. She gives talks on birding, works with landowners on bird habitat conservation, and leads birding walks and events. And she's known far and wide as the bird diva. Bridget, it's great to have you back.
Huzzah! More bird talk.
All bird talk all the time. So what does happen to birds? I mean, particularly during, like, the fall migration, the middle of the fall migration, when something like Hurricane Florence comes
around. I know,
around.
Right? And I think you watch what's happening and you think about those birds and how small some of them are, and how, well, and even the large ones getting tossed around by some of those winds. You worry, too, about whether they're all done breeding, because we know there are some birds that, you know, breed later in the summer. So a lot of concerns. There's a lot of excitement, too, that comes with a hurricane for birders. People get excited about seeing what might be blown in or blown off course. There's a lot to look at and start to pull apart. And what's super cool now is there's technology out there that's kind of helping to tease some of these things apart. Scientists don't exactly know how birds respond to some of these stressful weather events. And once again, you hear me say it all the time, you guys, eBird is this doorway into kind of getting some more data to be able to understand that. So there's this new service out there available through Cornell Lab of Ornithology called Birdcast. And it's come a long way even in the past year or so. And the idea is to be able to look at weather reports and weather radar, and then use those two data kind of sources to get an idea of what's happening to birds as they're migrating, when they're migrating, and then what happens in the case of a storm like this.
So how do researchers and scientists and bird watchers know that birds actually ride out the storm in its eye?
No, they don't. I mean, that's like a theory, right? So we're not quite sure yet. So part of it is that you can look at the radar of the storm and be able to see the differences in color, whether or not it's precipitation or whether or not it's like a physical object and then how big it is. So you can see some birds within that eye of the storm. You can also see
birds. You can actually, just to stop you there, because that's really cool. You can actually see on the radar when it might be something like a bird rather than
like a hailstone or something of that magnitude. Yeah. So, you know, for about 75 years or so, birders have been using weather radar just in general to be able to predict when birds are going to be or when they have taken flight at night. So typically you watch, and I learned how to do this a while ago and it was really complex, and I'm so glad there's an easier way to do it now. But, you know, go into the NOAA weather station and put this frequency up and that frequency up, and then make sure the colors are right so that green is actually precipitation and blue is birds, which is so counterintuitive as well. But what you could do is at night, you could, as the sun was setting, especially for our songbirds that are migrating at night, let's go and look at this radar and literally see them lifting off. And what Cornell has done now is they've kind of advanced this using all these different types of algorithms, years of weather data, and they're actually making predictions now. So there's something online called Birdcast. You can pull it up and it'll give you like a 3-day weather forecast out in advance. And they'll show you maps about the intensity of migration that is likely for your region. And I'll tell you, Jane, tonight is going to be a good one for our region. So our region right now is hot. So it's in the yellows and reds and oranges, which is where you want to look for migrating birds. So they've put these three maps up, and then they also provide you with another map that will show you in real time when the birds are taking off and how intense the flight is in that moment. they were also able to spin off a site that is tapped into the eBird reports that are coming in to kind of map some notable bird sightings from Hurricane Florence. So a lot of us were watching birds respond to the change in weather and the change in pressure, right? And a lot of them staying down. So what will happen when a storm starts to brew and come through and the birds start to feel this, they know to stay down and not to take off. And so we were able to watch some of that, but now we're able to look at where some of these birds have gotten blown into different areas. And what's really amazing is birds that are normally typically out over the ocean or they're coastal birds, they get blown inland. And so you have all these pelagic birds that are then arriving at inland lakes and reservoirs and things like that. And the site that they built from this came directly from eBird observations that were coming from people in the community.
You can also get a link to this BirdCast website that Bridget has been talking about. And our link will take you specifically to the Florence-related data that she's been discussing, because it's pretty amazing to see.
It just kind of blows my mind. So in the picture that they show you the path of the hurricane, and then they show you these series of dots that they've determined are potential, what we call hurricane birds. So there are things like shearwaters and jaegers and terns and some different types of gulls that normally you would just see along the coast, or you would see them out at sea. You'd have to be on a boat to be able to see these birds. And so there are all these little dots. So the bigger the dots are all color-coded by date. And the larger the dot, the larger the numbers that we're seeing. So there are some large dots around Raleigh. And so that's north of where the storm tracked. There are birds that have been blown in as far as Atlanta, Georgia, Tennessee. They're even mapping notable sightings up in West Virginia and D.C. from this storm. So it's really kind of fascinating to see what birders are able to contribute to our knowledge about how hurricanes affect birds.
What about Vermont's birds who might be migrating? Anything we need to worry about, or did they sort of lay low as you talked about?
Yeah, so I think, you know, obviously some of these birds might have gotten caught in the storm and they'll get blown off, of course, and that will stress them out as well. So that makes it really, really, I don't know, it's a kind of a sad thing to start to think about and deal with. The other piece that comes with any of these hurricane storms is their impact on different habitats and stopover sites for birds. So we see forests impacted. We see the flooding impact other places where birds might, like shorebirds might, it was mudflat before, and now it's all underwater. So they've got to keep flying and keep moving. So I think, yeah, the hurricane's definitely going to stress some of these birds. Some of them, I don't know, maybe the super smart ones, have figured out how to spin off the storm and use it to their advantage. So sometimes after a storm comes through, and this happens with smaller storms too, the birds take advantage of those tailwinds that kind of come through and pull after a storm and will ride those. And so they can get an advantage out of it as well.
It's pretty amazing sometimes, though, to be able to observe birds that are outside of their natural migratory pattern or outside of their natural habitat. Several years ago, I had a rufous hummingbird at my hummingbird feeder. And these are birds that are normally in the Rockies.
Right.
And to see it in a Vermont feeder was a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, it's just incredible. So, you know, there's stories out there, and the birding community does a really good job of trying to warn birders, because you get excited, like this opportunity to see birds that you would have to, you know, be out on a boat to see. They might show up at your local sewage treatment plant or the reservoir that normally just has mallards at it, and all of a sudden you're seeing crazy birds. So it is an exciting time, but it's also a time to, you know, reflect a little bit more on how weather patterns are starting to change, how we need to just be a little bit more diligent in protecting different habitats so that we continue to provide these stopover spaces. So when the storm goes by or in the calm after the storm, they have places to rest and rejuvenate.
Let's go to the phones. I could talk to you about the storm effects all day,
forever.
But we've got a lot of people who have a lot of questions about birds. And there are other things we want to talk about, too, like raptors and where to spot hawks right now in Vermont. But let's go to Nicole, who's calling in from Guilford. Hi, Nicole. You're on the air.
Hi, guys. I have something concerning bald eagles. I have something, I guess, is sort of an unusual sighting. One evening last week while my daughter was driving down 91, she almost hit a bald eagle with her car. That is, there was some roadkill on the road, and the eagle was obviously scavenging. Everything turned out to be all right, but she mentioned a couple things, one of which was that usually when there are birds scavenging on the road, say a crow or even like a vulture, they seem to be pretty quick to get out of the way. But in this case, the eagle seemed to sort of wait to the last minute. And the other thing is, with a bird of this size, it can take quite a while for it to gain much altitude and get out of the way. And anyway, I just thought I'd mention that usually when you hear people talking about sighting bald eagles, they're on the top of a tree or something, but usually it's moose that you have to worry about on the road.
Yeah.
Clearly, a collision wouldn't be good for a bird, but speaking as the dad here, I hope I can be forgiven for pointing out that, you know, with an animal this size, if such an accident would have the potential of, you know, being a danger to the driver as well.
That's, yeah, Nicole, thanks for pointing that out. What an interesting sighting for your daughter. I'm glad, you know, especially since she didn't actually get hurt herself or kill the bald eagle. What do you think, Bridget?
Yeah, and it's funny because I do a roadkill project as well called Wild Paths that is, you know, looks at successful and unsuccessful crossings of animals crossing the roadway. And it's mainly focused on mammals, but it's really amazing in even our data here that we're collecting in Vermont, the number of birds that are struck by cars. And so, you know, you've got to think that any time that we fragment habitat, it's not just about fragmenting habitat for the animals that are on the ground, but it's also fragmenting habitat for animals that are in the air. And bald eagles are scavengers, so they often bully other birds to get them to drop food, things like that, but they will scavenge as well.
And I've heard about that with owls, too. Owls getting hit by cars because of the same type of thing.
Oh, my gosh, right. We've talked about deep snows in the wintertime that drive animals to the roadways because the snow cover is less. And there's that, you know, split second when the rodent is running across the road that is just prime hunting time. Unfortunately, is a little dangerous.
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We are joined this hour by the bird diva, Bridget Butler, to talk about raptor declines, fall migration. I know Bridget likes to crowdsource. This is one of the ways that you appreciate doing things, not like you're the expert. You have to be the one who answers it.
Exactly. And one of the things I was thinking about as I was getting ready for this show is, like, where are people's favorite hotspots for fall migrants?
They shouldn't tell you that, Bridget.
Yes, they should.
You're going to encroach.
I'm going to celebrate and enjoy.
Yeah, sure. So you do want people to share hotspots.
Yeah, I think that would be great. You know, I think about raptor migration during this time of year, and there's definitely a couple sites in the state that are considered the hotspots. But I'm always curious, right? Like, there's thermals and there's mountains. There's thermals for those raptors to ride, and there's mountains everywhere. So where are you seeing raptors migrating?
All right. So where are you seeing raptors migrating, Bridget?
Where am I going to go this weekend? Well, let's see. The place that's closest to me is Mount Philo.
This is in Charlotte, Chittenden County.
Yep. So Mount Philo State Park. And there's typically folks there every weekend as we get into September and through maybe the first couple weeks in October that are, I'm going to make a joke here, hanging out, lying down on their backs. It's like the easiest birding ever because you just like lay back and look and count. Actually, it's really hard because when you think about it, a lot of these birds are backlit. So you get up to the top of Philo and folks are doing their best to try to count how many are moving through and what species they are. So it's an awful lot of fun. You kind of have a set idea of a group of birds that you can see. And there's this camaraderie and excitement about it.
And the fact that it's backlit by the sunlight makes it hard because you can't necessarily see the colors of the birds.
So, and this is something that I've really been enjoying as I think more about the slow birding work that I've been kind of cultivating and building some programs around, is really thinking about how do we look at birds for the things that aren't going to change on them. And especially during the fall, we get all these little warblers that are like first year warblers, and then we get the molting happening.
Right, because fall fashion can sometimes be very different than spring fashion on
so
birds.
Different on birds. And it's much more subtle, right? It's not the super flamboyant colors that we see in the springtime. And people find that really challenging. And so one of the things I like to look at are what are the things that aren't going to change on the bird? And the silhouette of a hawk is not going to change. The beak size or the head size in relation to the rest of the body is not going to change. The tail shape is not necessarily going to change. It'll change depending on what kind of flight the bird is in, but that comparison to how long the tail is to how big the body is, the proportions are always going to be the same. So really starting to train your eye to look for those things is an awful lot of fun.
All right, so you're going to Philo. You're going to see some raptors. I mentioned this because you've told us you want to talk about it, but I want to know more about this worldwide raptor decline.
Yeah, so I was really surprised to like see this pop up on my feed, and I guess I know bald eagles are still listed in the United States as an endangered species, and that osprey and other birds have had a hard time in terms of the face of DDT. And what's great in Vermont is a lot of those birds are rebounding and coming back. And so numbers of eagles are back. We had a great year for peregrine falcons in the state, which is just awesome. 55 pairs, I think our high before that was 51. They had an 88% success rate this year, which is huge, right? So 35 pairs fledged. We're looking at about 69 young out of that 35 pairs. Thanks, Margaret Fell from Audubon Vermont, for sending me those numbers. So I think when we look in our own little... like our own little small world, it looks really good. But on the global scale, these birds are really starting to show a drop in numbers. And I think a lot of it is because of threats to habitat, much like what we start to experience here, especially with forested habitat. And then there's also this piece about this this persecution that has happened with raptors over time, where raptors are seen as a threat to game species or domestic species that we're trying to raise. So across the world right now, 18% of raptors are threatened with extinction, and 52% of species have been declining pretty consistently in global populations. Hmm. So those are big numbers. The challenges with these birds is, you know, they're high on the food chain. So they take a long time to mature to be able to have young. So when we start to see those precipitous declines, like the red flags start to go off, because it's just going to be a little bit harder to kind of stabilize things again. And the other thing that's kind of fascinating, and I'm sure some of the listeners can talk about this because they've volunteered to help count peregrine falcons or to help on the bald eagle count. They occur in low population densities, so they're a little bit more challenging to study rather than something like forest songbirds, where you walk into, you know, a forested landscape and you know you're going to have X, Y, and Z type of different vireos or warblers or things like that. The densities are just really different.
Hmm. It's really interesting, and I'm going to be interested as we continue to chat, I hope, over the next many years, Bridget, to see how that goes in terms of, you know, can the numbers rebound globally? Let's go to Mike, who's calling in from Monroe, New Hampshire. Hi, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question. We're an avid hummingbird watchers with a feeder, and this year I spotted something a couple of weeks ago. This one hummingbird I always called the general because he would roost nearby and kick everybody off the feeder as soon as they landed, and then he fed and then he rolled over with his feet holding the perch, but he was virtually on his back with his head sticking out.
Yeah.
And then another, it was a male, and he's a male, and then another hummingbird came and went near him and hovered right above him. And his beak was facing her underside toward the back, and she was facing into the feeder. And they stayed there for about, I don't know, 5 minutes. In that position. They didn't touch, but she hovered right above him, and he was, you know, definitely doing something. I don't know whether it was a courtship or I never saw it in all the years we've been watching him.
So this is like the slow birding thing that I love right now, that I'm trying to get people to think a little bit more about. Like, how do we take advantage of those birds that are right in our backyard that have deeper stories to tell us other than, hey, I'm a ruby-throated hummingbird, and you've discovered one of those moments here. So I have never heard of this. So when you started to talk about the male going upside down, like, I've seen pictures of that. It's kind of, you know, there's a bunch of different theories about what it is, whether it's like, you know, like that food coma feeling that you have after you've totally filled up and you just kind of lay back.
So you think it was like,
I've totally gorged myself on this awesome nectar and now I'm just going to lay back for a minute. Is it an aggressive display that is basically like, I own this feeder? It's just another way of them saying that. But now you have this other interaction with another female coming in. And so the things that I, these are the things that pop through my head when you're saying this, right? So is this, like you said, is this a courtship display? Is he showing his robustness and his strength and his dominance of that feeder to her? And is she coming over and saying, yeah, wow, man, I'm really impressed with what you got going on here.
Totally into you, dude.
Totally into you. Let's go find a nest, build a nest. So all those things start to pop up in my head. Do I have an answer for you? No, but I have some great places for you to go to look for answers. So one of my new favorite resources, and I have a couple of them for really teasing out bird behavior. So there's this set of books by Donald and Lillian Stokes that are guides to bird behavior. And there's three of them, three volumes. And they do a little kind of vignette and like storytelling around the different behaviors that birds can show. So that's the first place that I would go. And then online, I have a subscription and it's really been worth it for people that like me that just want to keep diving deeper and deeper down the bird rabbit hole. I'm mixing my metaphors or something there. Is the Birds of North America online. And basically what it does is it takes all the research that's out there and kind of puts it in one place for each species of bird, and behaviors are in there. And I've discovered some really awesome little tidbits. So I had somebody come to me and tell me this story about a nuthatch doing, and I'm going to do the dance for you, Jane. Too bad this isn't TV. But a nuthatch kind of splaying its wings out, kind of just horizontal to the ground, and arching its chest up and kind of doing this, like, you know, back and forth teetering of its wings at another bird. And then later on, somebody on Vermont Birding on the Facebook page posted another nuthatch doing this. And that 2 days later, I saw one doing this in my backyard. So run to the books, run to Birds of North America online. Turns out it's an aggressive display that nuthatches use either in territory or when defending food sites. So the video clip online, you see this nuthatch doing this crazy dance display, and then all of a sudden a squirrel's head pops up and looks out. So it looks like maybe the nuthatch was trying to say, get away from my space, get away from me. But are these little moments that, like, when we slow down and we don't just say, ah, it's a nuthatch, I've seen one of those before, I'm going to keep going. Like, sit, take a minute or two more, because maybe they have something just a little bit more to reveal to you.
And probably because we've had an overabundance of squirrels this year, as we also know from a previous Vermont edition, you'll be seeing more nuthatches, or have been seeing more
nuthatches. Are going to be doing that dance for a while.
While we're talking hummingbirds very quickly, which we've sort of gotten away from, but that's what Mike was originally asking us about. Nancy said, have the hummingbirds left early? I haven't seen them in the Northeast Kingdom in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. So, you know, these guys, a lot of birds are going to start their migratory routes and start moving on in response to food availability. So I always tell people to look at the landscape and think like a hummingbird. So while hummingbirds, you know, we mostly identify them as eating nectar sources, they're also going to be looking for insect sources. So as the weather gets cooler and the insects start to die off, a lot of these birds have to move on. So when the flowers on the landscape start dying off, that's when the hummingbirds are going to move too.
But maybe don't really think like a hummingbird, because as Mike pointed out, those guys are jerks.
Yeah, they can be a little too aggressive. Don't do that at the dinner table, please.
Pat wants to know, what's happening in the life of the orioles when they suddenly stop devouring the grape jelly and oranges? Does this mean the babes have fledged and they've all flown off for greener pastures?
Oh, wow. That's fascinating. Depends on how, you know, tell me when the grape jelly feeding stops. And yeah, that sounds like a really good theory. So if you're seeing the grape jelly feeding stop maybe, you know, sometime in June, and all of a sudden they're gone, they're probably busy feeding young. And then maybe they'll be bringing the babies back as you get toward the end of June and July, and they're teaching these scruffy looking birds how to feed from the jelly feeder. So that's another fascinating behavior to kind of watch for.
Sydney in Putney says, Bridget didn't mention the most productive hawk watch and hawk count site in Vermont.
Not.
That is the Putney Mountain Hawk Watch, which usually counts over 10,000 migrating raptors every fall. A citizen hawk watch team undertakes the count every day of the week, not just weekends, and the count spans over 2.5 months. The hawk watch team welcomes others to join them on Putney Mountain and observe the hawk count. And Joe, you want to say something?
Yeah, no, I have the I do have the numbers here. You guys are right. I'm sorry I didn't fit you in, but I'm so glad you said it for me instead because you did it so awesome.
And Joe and Chester emailed in to say, last night I saw a barred owl swooping down on a frog.
Yes.
I didn't realize that frogs were a part of their diet, especially with all the squirrels and rodents that are around.
Oh my gosh, right? Well, you know, you got to mix it up a little bit, right? You don't want to eat squirrel all the time.
Legs are a delicacy.
Oh my gosh, they're yummy. Tasty. I don't know if I'd go for worms, though.
Do barred owls go for worms?
Yes, they do go for worms. So there are these wonderful videos online that you can find of owls at night in some of these seeps or places after it's rained. You know how all the earthworms come up and the owls are sitting there on the ground picking up earthworms and eating them. So a very, very diverse diet. They're foodies, man.
But that's so tough because I am a owl pellet enthusiast. Ooh. And I'm not sure what you'd be able to see in an owl pellet that would tell you that this owl has been eating worms and frogs instead of, you know, vertebrates.
Maybe you don't have to cough up anything if you eat. Well, if you eat frogs, you're definitely going to have to cough up some legs. But if you eat, if you got a diet of worms, no coughing for you.
So maybe it's even better.
Yeah.
We're going to ask Bridget Butler more questions, including something I feel like this maybe is a plant about corvid research, because Bridget is a big fan of crows. So we're going to talk crows. We're going to talk other questions about birds as we continue our fall migration show with the bird diva, Bridget Butler. All right. I teased you, Bridget, with this corvid research question, and I know you're a big crow fan.
I am.
Sharon and Bill in West Barnet want to know about crow and raven behavior and intelligence. And they ask, is there evidence to show whether ravens are more intelligent than crows? And what is that evidence? We have both crows and ravens around our property in West Barnet.
Oh my gosh. You know, what a fascinating research project that could be.
First of all, remind us how to tell the difference between a crow and a raven.
It's like size and
beak shape are
okay, so,
key, right?
Right. So, and I'm gonna open my big book here that I have on birds of North America. And so one of the things, I mean, that we tend to go to all the time is size. And everybody's like, well, you know, a crow is bigger than a raven. But if you don't have a crow and a raven sitting right next to each other, that's not very helpful. So this is where you really have to go back to size in proportion to something else on the bird's body. So stay within the bird's body. And often that is what can really kind of help you clinch the ID. Things that have really been helping me lately are to look at the tail. So the tail of a raven has a wedge, like a point to it. And so when it's flying and it's kind of spread out, there's kind of a little bit of a point to it. On a crow, it's going to be nice and rounded so that you can look at the tail. The other thing that I like to look at is this, when they're in flight, there's this long head and long bill on a raven in comparison. So long head, long bill, they're pretty much equal in length. And it's just a little bit slightly different for crows. So the crow's beak doesn't have that same length as the head. The other part that I'm keying in on a lot with ravens is this shagginess to the feathers under the throat. And I've actually been able to see this with them in flight. So I just get the silhouette. I'm not even able to look at the bird in a way that I can see the shape on the tail, but I can see the long head, long beak, and then this kind of, it's almost like a waddle, right? Like underneath that comes from the shagginess of the feathers there. So,
but who gets to join Mensa, the crow or the raven?
I don't know. So from what I've read in terms of looking at and studying corvids is most of the intelligence work has been done with crows. And there's the new crow of Catalonia that is the one that can use tools. So crows have been shown to use tools. Ooh, I think that might give them the leg up on the raven.
But ravens can quote poetry, right?
Oh my gosh, right? They can. So, you know, I'm stuck here. I hope this isn't like a couple's question where it's like one of you is like, I say raven, and the other one says crow. I will turn you on, though, to a researcher out west in Seattle who is studying, well, she just moved on to gray jays, but she has a beautiful blog on corvids in general. And so she just recently published a paper on her work with crows and like crow funerals and how crows will flock to when there's a dead crow and they kind of all congregate together. Her name's Kaylee Swift, and she does this great game on Twitter that's actually helped me a lot. She plays once a week with her Twitter followers. She plays crow or no crow. And her followers send her pictures from all over the world of crows and ravens. And there are more than one species of crow as well. So she then teases out these little things that you can look at in these photos to be able to tell the difference between
the
two.
I follow one that's cougar or not. Once a week.
Cougar or no cougar.
Yeah, cougar, yep. No cougar. Let's go to Craig, who's calling in from Callis. Hi, Craig. Thanks for waiting. Hey, Craig. You there?
Hi. Sorry. Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Hi, Bridget.
Hey.
So I'm an avid warbler watcher.
Yes.
And my morning routine is to go out on my porch with a cup of coffee and see who's there. And in the summer, I always have common yellow-throats nesting, and I've also got indigo buntings right around and crassonitaries. And usually in the fall, it's limited to yellow-rumped and some flycatchers that are still around. You know, the indigos and everybody have taken off. But this year, I'm seeing a black and white one morning and several black-throated blues and black-throated greens. I mean, with really vibrant color and a little yellow guy that I just can't quite put my finger on. But I'm wondering, is there something different this year, or is it just they have found lots of little worms in my bushes and trees and love it right there? But it just seems like a lot more than usual.
A lot more than usual. And can I ask you, how long have you been doing this practice of going out and sitting with the cup of coffee? Is this like 1 or 2 years or multiple years?
20.
Ooh, all right.
20 years.
Regularly for 20 years. So you have like a background knowledge now that's built about your place and your site. So this is something that's popped up new for you. I think that's really cool. So let's see. I think there's probably a number of things that can affect whether or not warblers are any of these migrating songbirds are showing up in our backyard. And right. So when it's migration, anything is really possible. And the things that are going to influence whether or not they're going to get pushed down have a lot to do with the weather, once again. So going back to what we were talking about at the top of the show with BirdCast, sometimes you will be able to look at BirdCast the night before. So before you go to bed at night, pull up BirdCast, see if it's going to be a good night for migration. And then you can really be prepared the next morning. So sometimes it's the weather pattern that's going to drop those birds out really well in your backyard. And of course, if the food sources are good, and we're seeing this with some different insect pests this year. So we have, sometimes there are higher incidences of insect pests in our trees and things like that. So then that is going to cause birds to kind of be drawn to that site and forage more. So I'd play around with BirdCast a little bit, see if you can kind of predict when you're going to have some of these birds in your backyard. I would make note of what the season is like as well. I often, right now, this drought thing, I feel like it's almost been good for insects in a way, that there's just, it's just giving them a bit of an advantage. And so then the birds are there to feed on them.
Let's go to Clayton calling in from Burlington. Hey, Clayton.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a quick question. I was working as a carpenter for about 10 months in Charlotte, right on the water on this big residential project. And one morning, the fog hadn't lifted on the lake, and it was about 7:30 or so in the morning. And I noticed it appeared to be thousands of birds just flying right over the water for 10 or 15 minutes straight.
Yeah.
And I was told they were cormorants. And I was just curious if there is a spot to see where they might land, like you can with the Canadian geese. You know, you can find fields where they're all gathered. And there are so many cormorants that I was just curious if where they land and if there's an opportunity to see them.
Totally. So here's the thing. You probably want to get out on the water or find some of these little bays and inlets. I had the pleasure of going out on the pelagic bird cruise with Alan Strong from UVM. We took the Melisyra out, which is UVM's research vessel. I think it was like not last weekend, but the weekend before. They did a trip Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. They had so much interest. So we went out on the lake. And we were looking for some of the birds that are more like to be out on the open bodies of water, which includes cormorants. The ones that we were really excitedly looking for were some of the Jaegers. These are seagull-like birds that actually bully seagulls. But the number of birds that we saw the most of were the double-crested cormorants, and they were there by the thousands. I think we got up into like 2,000 with our count at the end of the four-hour trip. But they were streaming down the lake, and they end up kind of all congregating together in some of these little bays and inlets.
So they're on the water but looking for a sheltered bay?
Yeah, sheltered bay where they can dive for food.
I want to squeeze one more call in here from Audrey in Rutland. Hey, Audrey.
Hi. You talked about the crow funeral, but yesterday there was a dead crow in my backyard, and towards dinner time, I could hear this group of crows overhead. They caw, 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 caw. They carried on. Then they flew off.
Yeah.
And I invited my neighbor to open her door, and she said, I can hear them. They're going crazy. And then again this morning, early morning, a group came again, and they caught away, and away they flew. And so I said, I think they recognize that's once their fallen comrade.
Yeah.
And they're either saying goodbye or what happened or I'm so sad. And I thought how unusual, because a crow, I don't think about a crow being dead.
Yeah.
I think about a crow up above and making all that noise.
Yeah. Or showing recognition of another individual that has died. It's really fascinating. So some of Kaylee Swift's work kind of takes a little bit of a deeper dive into some of this. And she actually, in a way, baited resident crows on the campus that she was working on to study their responses. And she found some fascinating things that I'll just leave hanging there for you to Google.
Well, we'll try to put a link up on today's show page. And it's a good reminder, Audrey, that, you know, we're not the only animals that have social structures and feelings about the creatures that we live alongside. And it's a great reminder to think about that. Bridget, it was so fun, as always. We got sort of deep into some interesting topics today. Bridget Butler is a birding enthusiast and consultant. She gives talks on birding. She's giving one tonight at the Georgia Public Library at 7. So if you're listening at 7, it's like a weird time warp. She works with landowners on bird habitat conservation and leads birding walks and events. And we have a link to her Bird Diva website at vpr.net. Bridget, thanks.
Thanks, Jane.